A little bit about the airplane. They built about 12,500 of them. The vast majority, almost 9,000, were built by chance vought. So if it's a chance vought airplane, the designator will be an F4U dash, usually either a 1 or a 4. This is a 5. Goodyear was given a big contract to help manufacture these things in Akron, and if it was built by Goodyear and they built a couple thousand, Goodyear's designation was an FG1D. A lot of people always come up to you when you have the airplane and they say, how many of them did they make? They made about 12,500. How many of them did they make where the wings didn't have to fold? They all folded. They were all foldable. They didn't always get folded if they were land-based for a while. So they all fold. Somebody else will come up and say, you know, I thought it had a three-bladed prop. Well, depending on the model, some had a three-bladed. Later aircraft had the four-bladed. So starting with the Dash 4s and onward, they had four-bladed prop. They all had a Pratt 2800, R2800 engine, some version of it. I think as you approach the airplane for the first time like I did, I was amazed at the size of it. If you haven't been up close and personal with a Corsair before, you walk, as you get closer, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger compared to, say, a Mustang or a P-39 Air Cobra. It's a large aircraft. It weighs 2,000 pounds, empty weight, more than, say, a P-51. It's a complex aircraft. The aircraft is a hydraulic airplane. It has 8 hydraulic subsystems. And the next airplanes that were made after this era were jets. So the systems on this aircraft were sort of a precursor to the systems that you would find on a jet. And other than the canopy operation, which was changed on the Dash 5, the systems on the F9 Cougars and Panthers were pretty much the same as a Corsair. The wings do fold right here. And that's, of course, so they can have more deck space available on the carriers. In those days, they had just a single straight deck. And I think the first time I got around a carrier, I was always amazed because everybody would, you know, say, God, how can you land that jet in 800 feet or 1,000 feet, depending on which carrier you're on? And I hated to tell them, but we really only land in about 200 feet. Just the rear 200, we take off in about 200 feet. So it's interesting. These prop airplanes, although they ended up with catapults, and there are catapult hooks on the aircraft, they did not require a catapult if you could get a good deck run. The airplane can develop 2,000 horsepower or more, depending on whether you can use water injection or not. The other thing that strikes you is, you know, the gull wing. There weren't too many gull wing aircraft, and so everybody always asks, you know, why did this aircraft have a gull wing? And as you can see, if we were to rotate this propeller down to the vertical position, there's really only about 13 inches of clearance, even with the gull wing. So what they did is they, in order to get a huge prop on there, they have a bit of a dip in the wing. And that forces the gear to be farther down without having to have a very long gear strut. If you're familiar with the Grumman's F8F Bearcat, you'll notice that it has a very long, and there's one out there, very long gear strut. But the more landing gear you have to retract into the wings, the less ability you have to store things like fuel, which is dear to my heart, ammunition, rockets, bombs, things like that. So chance vought said we're gonna have a great combination. We're gonna have a shorter gear, although when it lifts off, the gear drops another 8, 12, or 13 inches down on the strut. Comes up, and the gear comes up and rotates, kind of interesting, up into the well. And so the gull wing is to get the prop up off the deck, especially when you touch down. There might be a tendency in some pilots, not all pilots, of course. Some pilots might hit with authority, and the gear will compress, and we don't want to strike the prop on the deck, especially during World War II when we had wooden decks. The other surprising thing to me was that it was the first airplane I flew where there is no fuel in the wing. There's no fuel in this wing. And there were no fuel in any of the wings after the first early birds, the Corsairs. So all the fuel is either in jettisonable drop tanks or from the engine compartment firewall back to the beginning of the windscreen. That's the fuel, 255 gallons. So you have 2 or 3 hours without a dogfight of fuel. And then if you put on drops, you've got 5, 6 hours without a fight. And so it's got tremendous loiter time. And it carries several thousand rounds of 50 caliber ammunition normally. This version here is set up as an AU-1 wing, meaning that it has cannon in there, which was a great air-to-ground weapon. What else is interesting? Sit way back. If you look at that cockpit area when you're sitting in the office, you're sitting at the rear, the trailing edge of the wing, rather than you'd like to be, you know, up front and in the middle of it. You're sitting way in the back. And so that, compared with having to extend the nose, the prototype, the engine compartment, was right back up against the windscreen. Well, then when they decided they needed the wing area for other things, like landing gear operations and weapons, they added that big fuel tank on there, and that pushed the nose way out there in front. So then you would pick up, you know, the way of Americans is to always use slang for everything. You know, hardly anyone's Robert, you know, it's Bob, Billy Bob, Bobby. And so this airplane, pilots wouldn't call it, you know, what are you flying? You know, fighter pilots have a lot of machismo, attack pilots almost have as much. And they say, well, what are you flying? You know, he says, well, he wouldn't say, I'm flying the F4U-4 Corsair. You know, fighter pilot says, I'm flying the hose nose, you know, the ensign eater or the big blue devil or something. But when you sit back in the office there, and you've got 8 or 9 feet up until the front, and you come around to see that aircraft carrier, and you're landing straight on a straight deck, you can't see the boat. So that makes for interesting patterns. So they would have a circling pattern, and you're always looking out the left-hand side of the windshield, and you roll wings level right as you cross the stern of your boat, and Hail Mary. So real long nose, can't see out the front. I don't think it's as good a gun platform as the Hellcat. The Hellcat, the nose slopes downward from the windscreen. Corsairs, you can see, is straight. So if you really have the enemy of the day boresighted, you can't see him under the nose of the aircraft. So you're going to be taking what we call deflection shots. What else is interesting about the Corsair is that the Americans came out with the first lead computing gun sight at that time. And it had different model numbers for the same sight, depending on who bought it and who used it, which airplane. K-12 was option, but they would have a gun sight in there and lead computing, so that was great. What a great airplane. This airplane was the only airplane not canceled at the end of World War II. Every other contract by the middle of August of 1945 was canceled, except the Corsair. No more P-51s, the world's most famous fighter in some terms. No more P-51s, P-39s, P-82s. No more fighters were stayed in production except the Corsair, and the Corsair stayed in production until 1953. And the -7 versions was purchased by the French because of its tremendous air-to-ground capability. Show up over the forward air controller, you've got 3 or 4 hours of fuel. You might have 10 5-inch air-to-ground rockets, 2,000 pounds of ammo, and 2 500-pound bombs. You can't have that good a time today in Afghanistan. So tremendous air-to-ground, very popular airplane. The construction price, purchase price for the government of a P-51 in 1944 was $61,000. The purchase price of a Corsair was $93,000. A lot more airplane, more systems, better negotiators, I don't know, but it cost a lot of money. So here you have thousands of these things flying around with young guys like Captain Hudner, and he wasn't born like this. And they're getting this airplane with 200 or 300 hours total time, go to the transition squadron, maybe get a little bit of time, not a lot, maybe sometimes hanging around till the boat goes or till they get shipped over, and away you go. And you're in a fight of your life. Now, there were some performance snags on carrier suitability for the aircraft, and that's a program that they all go through at Patuxent River in Maryland, where the Navy does its acceptances. Interesting story, by the way. The contract, like all contracts, called for the Navy test pilot to be able to enter into a full five-turn spin and recover and climb back up and another five full-turn spins in the opposite direction and recover. And after the manufacturer lost two airplanes trying to do that demonstration, which is not unreasonable, they approached the Navy and they said, you know, if you really need these airplanes, well, we don't want to do spins. And the Navy signed off on it. So, but where there was a carrier suitability problem, the airplane had a tendency to come in, even with the best of pilots, to bounce a little bit. And as it would, even though in those days, instead of four arresting cables, they had up to 20. Admiral, wouldn't that have been great? You know, 20 cables. Nice. Three wire. We have a Navy admiral here, making sure I say everything right. And so they couldn't keep this thing from bouncing over the cables and maybe landing farther down, or, God forbid, you bounce, and as you get up into the air, then your cable catches on the hook. You come slamming down, and those big, strong landing gear go up through the wing. Looks real weird. Taxi's slow. So they had a problem, and they couldn't get it fixed. And so all that production is coming offline, the FG-1Ds, and they were going to be given to the Marines. Now, VF-17, I think it was, with Tom Blackburn, they actually went out on the first Navy deployment, but they were immediately launched after the first or second event and sent over, and they worked off land for a year. And so the odd thing I think about the history of the airplane is famous World War II Navy airplane. The Navy didn't get to operate it full-time off of aircraft carriers until December of 1944. So they got, you know, at a maximum 8 or 9 months in operations with the Navy. Now, the Marines have been running it for a couple years, Pappy Boyington and the FG-1Ds and Black Sheep Squadrons. So an interesting airplane. Any questions about the airplane or the environment before we get to the Korean War and heroes? Yes, sir. You never have enough fuel or rudder. It is an interesting tail section empennage. If you'll notice that the horizontal stabilizer, instead of being at the leading edge of the vertical stabilizer, it's halfway back. But if you look at the size of the vertical, the question was, if you can't hear it over there because of the hurricane, is the rudder big enough? And, of course, depending on the pilot, the rudder may never be big enough. But if you look at that vertical, you can see the tremendous size of it, or as we would call it in the Navy, maybe sail area. And so this has no steerable tail wheel, like other tail draggers at the time, sadly. And so as you're taxiing on a day like this with a 90-degree crosswind, that airplane's trying to weather vane you on the whole time, and you're stepping on the opposite brake, which for what could be 5,000-6,000 feet, by the time you get to take off, you have no right brake available to you or whatever. So the rudder is a good size, and it's not really not a problem. The airplane has tremendous flying qualities, lands easily, as I was warned, lands like a butterfly with tennis shoes on. It's just a great landing airplane, takes off, flies great. And we sometimes will do a two-ship takeoff with a P-51. We have to put the Corsair on the wing. On the side, let the P-51 lead, because the thrust-to-weight ratio on a Corsair is 22% greater than a P-51. And they had a couple of them test flown against each other during the middle of the war. All the services asked to send their best pilots and their best fighters down to Eglin, and they had a fly-off, and the Navy guys flew the Army airplanes, and the Army flew the Navy, and fought each other and everything. And there's a really good report you can read if you're interested.